Let's go.
Welcome to Micromobility, a podcast exploring the disruptive potential of small electric vehicles. We cover the best companies building these amazing new vehicles, as well as topics relevant to how they impact people, cities, and our planet. My name is Oliver Bruce, an investor in mobility and climate tech, and my co-host is Horace Dedieu, founder of Asimco.com and Micromobility Industries. Hey team, Oliver here. This week I interview Oliver Obutur, one of the founders of Microlina, who are producing one of, in my opinion, the most beautiful cars that I have seen in the neighborhood electric vehicle space. This thing is an electric version of the iconic BMW Isetta from the mid-1950s, these micro cars that they built after World War II. I really loved this interview for a few reasons. Firstly, because the operators, Oliver and his father, Wim, were some of the real OGs of the micromobility space, setting up a company literally called Micromobility back in the early 2000s and producing the first kick scooters and then subsequently some of the first electric kick scooters in the industry. Secondly, anybody who is producing small cars, especially small electric cars at any sort of scale, deserves to be congratulated. And this has been a real journey for them, especially as they have done it entirely self-funded off the back of their original acoustic and electric scooter business, as we get into. I have really enjoyed getting to know Oliver and looking forward to hopefully having him at Micromobility Europe in June. Speaking of which, if you are interested in the latest in lightweight electric vehicles, including electric bikes, scooters, or neighborhood electric vehicles like this, or everything in between, you will absolutely love Micromobility Europe. It is the show I am most pumped about in terms of what we've produced at Micromobility Industries, and I'm sure you will have an absolute blast. Come and hang out with myself, but also with Horace and more than 1,000 others as we talk about what the future of these light vehicles will enable for our cities. I am running the startup stage with more than 60 companies expected to pitch. It is going to be pandemonium, and I cannot wait. Get your tickets at micromobility.io and come and hang out. And with that, here is Oliver.
Let's go.
And welcome back to Micromobility. We have with us today another Oliver, actually, Oliver Obutur, who is from Microlina, one of the founders of this very fascinating car, which I hope you have a chance to see. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. How are you today, Oliver?
Pretty good. What about you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. It's late at night in New Zealand and midday-ish, I think, in the Netherlands. Italy.
Switzerland.
Forgive me. Yeah, so look, hey, I'm beyond excited to have this conversation. Again, this is one of these vehicles that I have seen when you first unveiled it, I think 2014?
We first showed the Microlino in 2016. We started the project in 2015, but we first showed it in 2016.
Yeah. I remember seeing this and just going, I'm so excited that someone is trying to re-kick off the BMW Isetta, because it's such an iconic vehicle. So look, I wanted to start because I think you actually have probably one of the most interesting real OG stories of micromobility out of anybody in the industry that I've met to date. So can you talk me through, obviously, your family's background in the micromobility game and how on earth you kind of, before, and then we'll get to how you ended up starting a small micro car company. But I do want to start in the place of, you know, your dad and what he was doing back in the day.
Sure. I mean, my dad, coming from an entrepreneurial family, and he always wanted to do something of himself. And during the 80s and 90s, his vision was to create a product that would be put in everyone's garage, basically. So something that everyone could use. And he was living in Zurich at the time. And it was just sort of, let's say, Switzerland was a bit behind when it comes to sort of this fast food type of restaurants. But there was one in Zurich downtown, and it was about 15, 20 minutes away from where he lived. And although public transport is pretty good in Switzerland, even at that time, especially at night, it was a bit cumbersome to take the tram to go there and so on and so forth. And so he thought, I need a product that essentially is collapsible, so I can store it in my car, but also in my apartment. I don't have to pump any wheels, whatever. I can go to my favorite snack bar and literally just put it into a backpack because it's so collapsible. So something that is faster than walking, yet more portable than a bike. So he really started thinking about this new type of product category. So that was in the 80s and 90s. He also built a prototype back then, had all this idea of micromobility, and also showed it to his friends. But unfortunately, they just laughed at him. So he actually, for many years, he never ended up pursuing this product. So it's just sort of let there idle in the garage, not being used. It was a few years later when my brother and me were a few years old, and we were living in a neighborhood with a lot of kids, when some neighborhood kids, they just sort of discovered, so it was like sort of a public garage, they sort of discovered this first prototype he built. And well, they started riding it secretly. So they didn't tell him, of course, and they started riding it secretly. And I had so much fun with it that, he sort of realized, okay, at least from a, let's say, fun perspective, it works. It was also at the same time, pretty much when in Switzerland, the Smart was being invented at the time by Nicholas Hayek, which was, this is the owning family of Swatch and Omega. And Nicholas Hayek was sort of the Elon Musk of Switzerland at the time. So really like the very famous entrepreneur. And he had a vision of creating a two-seater electric car, super portable. So it was sort of, at least in Europe in the 90s, there was sort of starting to come a thinking of, you know, how can we change the way we move, new types of mobility. And it sort of fit perfectly into my dad's vision, which was really this new product category, faster than walking, more collapsible than a bike. So yeah, that's actually when sort of he started again this project and started approaching them. So that was in the mid-90s, I think in 1995, 1996, around that time, to sort of give them the idea of micromobility, saying that for first and last mile, to make a micro scooter, as he called it. And they loved the idea, and to put a micro scooter in every trunk. And yeah, they signed a letter of intent. And that was sort of his entry ticket into really starting this type of business. But at the end of the day, it was really, he had the vision already long before. It was a new product category between walking and biking. But it took a while until he actually had the courage to sort of go the next step beyond just making one prototype.
And so that ended up becoming micromobility, and the company was called Micromobility, and you sold scooters. Talk me through that part, because obviously he started selling them and the sales figures were insane.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, of course, the story is a pretty long one, but Smart had, before they launched, they had problems with a so-called elk test, which is a tip-over test.
Oh yeah, of course.
And what happened was that the whole management team, after they didn't pass it, they said, all right, we are. They changed the whole management team, and then this little project with us was not really that relevant for them anymore. So he never actually ended up working together with Smart, but it was his sort of door opener at the time. He then in parallel had an idea for another type of product, which was a three-wheeler called the Kickboard. So the Kickboard was more sort of a fun product, also to have this sort of surf feeling that you have in a skateboard. And also for that, in Swiss people are always very pragmatic. So he always knew, okay, I will never make this. I will never be able to do this without a partner. So he was looking for a partner and for this three-wheel Kickboard. And the partner he found in the end was the sportswear brand K2. Maybe you know K2.
I do. Yeah.
They make skis, rollerblades, all kind of things. They were, especially in the 90s, I think they were huge. And so he visited them in Seattle. And the answer of the management at the time was, well, not even a dead kid wants to be seen on that product. So that was the that was the answer of them. So it was sort of the not invented here syndrome, where the brand just thought, well, we didn't invent it, and that's why we don't like it, basically. But he was lucky, because one of their executives in Europe, he really liked the concept of the three-wheeled Kickboard and gave my father a chance to exhibit at the ISPO in Munich. That was in 1999. And they made 10 prototypes and showed it at this International Sports Fair in Munich. That was at the time was a very big industry event, and it was massive success. So immediately, you know, it was the highlight of the exhibition, and yeah, that sort of started giving him his first revenues. And then, of course, at the time he said, "Okay, guys, would you like to do the two-wheeler as well?" So the micro scooter, which was his initial idea, and which was, let's say, a bit more focused towards really everyday mobility. And then their answer was, no, that's not really fitting our core of a sportswear fun brand and so on. And so then he decided, and at that point, he also had the capital to do it himself, because as I said, he was already pretty successful with the three-wheel kickboard. He said, okay, well, then I'm going to do it myself. And that's when he founded Micro Mobility Systems. So actually, I think one of the first times the word micromobility has been used, and probably the first company that was named after micromobility was then subsequently founded.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you were the trailblazers in that regard.
Yeah. So that was really just a couple months after launching the kickboard. And the micro scooter, let's say the success was more than 10 times of the success of the kickboard. So what it meant, basically, we sold 80,000 micro scooters per day. Each day, 80,000 micro scooters. We had we worked with a...
Which is totally nuts, by the way. That number, 80,000 scooters a day back in 2001, 2002, 2003, that is real product market fit. That was the thing that totally blew me away.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, no marketing involved, right? It was just sort of a viral product. That was just to also get an imagination of the size. So that's 20 40-foot containers leaving the factory every day.
Yeah, wow.
20 40-foot containers. The company where we manufacture with used to have 500 employees. And eventually, they went up to 16,000 people within 12 months. So it was an incredible boom.
Yeah,
incredible boom.
And then obviously, because I know that story didn't, you know, it wasn't all rosy daisies and wonderful things that happened there. Because I mean, I know that there were a lot of competitors in that market as well, right? Like that was a difficult product to defend.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, we had all types of patents and so on. But it's really hard to enforce a patent if you have 200-300 companies copying you at the same time. And also that in, let's say, countries where jurisdictions are maybe not as focused on IP protection.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it was basically impossible to sort of protect it. That has also been really our learning. Let's say if you're successful, you're going to get copied. That's just how it is. It's difficult. You have to stay innovative, and but that was the learning. And of course, what also happened was, and I think in later times, this has been probably seen in other industries sectors as well, where you have a product that becomes really sort of this viral hit, and then you got all of a sudden everyone thinks you can make money. And when everyone thinks you can make money in this industry, it's pretty much the time when nobody will make money anymore.
Yes.
Because there are too many people entering. And that's just what happened, right? There was like the market was way, way, way oversaturated. So you had too many products flooding the market, and eventually overstockages at retailers, a lot of discounts. Then all of a sudden there is some guy from some country for product safety comes up with an idea of some kind of strange use case. What could happen to a consumer if they use this product? And so they make some kind of new law, which basically means that all the stuff you have in stock, you can't sell anymore. So let's say pretty much everything that can go wrong went wrong after that first boom, I have to say. Mm. And so that was a really, really tough time. So a very fast ascent, which lasted about 1.5 years. And a pretty sharp decline afterwards, because the market was oversaturated and it was just a bloodbath.
Yeah, wow. And so talk me through like what happens after that and then getting into Microlino, because Microlino started, you know, this is 10, 15 years later.
Sure. I mean, maybe a side note, because I assume we have a lot of American listeners as well. Actually, many Americans probably know the Razor scooter. in the US. Razor Scooter was...
Oh, yeah, I know the Razor Scooter. I was actually going to ask you about the Razor Scooter. My brother had one of those. They were like, yeah, so cool.
Exactly. So because the market increased so quickly, my father at the time decided to give his partner in China, that was the one that was producing for him, sort of right to make a deal directly with an American company that would be able to sell his product under their own brand name in the US. Because let's say it was just too much growth to handle for the small team we had here. And we wanted to move fast. So that's what we did. And that was Razor. So actually it was the Razor scooter was actually the micro scooter. They just did a different branding and it was a different sort of distribution company. But it was essentially initially produced in the same factory. So yeah, this is also quite a funny side note. So that also the Razor scooter originally came from Micro, and now we don't have anything to do with each other anymore. But yeah, in this early phase, it was exactly the same product.
Yeah, that's amazing. The one thing that I'm going to note for the audience is that there were many cheap scooters that were imitations, and my brother had a Razor scooter, and I remember it being distinctly really high quality and very good, and you could do jumps on it without bending it, which was the kind of the point of why you wanted to own a scooter when you were a kid.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that has been really, I think, one of the smartest decisions was that we never compromised for quality. So we never went for cost. We really sort of designed and always still design our product to be durable, to be long lasting. And sort of this gave us a reputation in the market of, you know, really being the quality brand. And I think that is still resonating today, right? I mean, I still have people that remember they had one of the first micro scooters and they were saying like, well, they're indestructible. You know, they had great quality. And it's true. I mean, we still have people that come in with their 20-year-old scooters to get a new set of wheels or something. So that's still so present. But that was a massive ascent. We struck a deal. You had to make a lot of fast decisions, like the one with Razor and also others. And after, there was really a big decline, not just for us, for the whole market, honestly. I mean, it was just an oversaturated market. And at that point, you had to really focus on your strengths. You had to think about your values, and you also had to build the business organically. And I think there's always two sides of the story, right? So on one hand, it's super nice if you have this sort of overnight success. On the other hand, it doesn't really give you the time to build your brand, to sort of make your mark in the world. And so sort of what happened with the hoverboards, and I think also with other later product categories that emerged, where all of a sudden nobody really knows what's the original and what's the good product anymore, because, you know, it just popped up, and after 12 months, they were like hundreds of brands, right? And you don't know which, you can't tell the good from the bad ones. So we really focused on quality and innovation. So that was what we focused the later years, and it has proven extremely successful. I think most notably, we have around more than 50 different products. Most notably is, for example, in 2004, we launched a specific kids version of our kickboard, so of this three-wheel scooter, which was targeted at kids. So
I know the one. You see them literally everywhere. They're two wheels at the front, one at the back. They're kind of plastic formed.
Yeah.
And they seem to be like every kid has one of these things. So
yeah,
you've clearly built an interesting business off the back of that. But I'm conscious of time, and I want to work out how we get to Microlino. So how did that happen?
Sure. Yeah. So we always focused on innovation and quality. We launched a lot of different products, and the Microlino was something that started as an idea in 2015. Because I still remember there are of course always several influences to it. One of them was that we were at the car show in Geneva, and we saw all these huge SUVs, and we were like, I mean, there's just too many large cars being presented, you know. And pretty much at the same time, we read a study about that on average, there are just about 1.2 people sitting in a car driving just about 35 kilometers a day. So if you look at these statistics, you think, well, wait a minute, most cars are totally over-engineered for what they're actually being used for. And this was the start when we sort of started thinking, okay, how could we create a product that sort of fits into this everyday use case? Of course, we were very much inspired by the original Smart Vision, which never was actually followed in the way that the founder, Niklas Haig, imagined. But nevertheless, that was a big inspiration for us, sort of two adults next to each other and space for three beer crates. That was sort of the claim at the time.
Yeah.
We also still thought this is a very contemporary idea. It still sort of made more sense in 2015 than it made in 1999. So it was even more important now. And during our research phase, we said, okay, so how would this thing need to look like? And you have to remember that at that point, it was really just a fun project for us. It wasn't something that we are actually thinking of producing. It was just like an idea we toyed with, and we were thinking, oh, you know, maybe we'll do a PR gag or whatever. We didn't really have a clear plan behind what would be the next steps. We were just toying with this idea and dreaming around. And yeah, we stumbled across the bubble cars from the 50s, which you were mentioning earlier. The most famous one was, of course, the BMW iZeta, which was actually a product invented in Italy by a company named Iso Rivolta that then licensed to BMW this design for the German market. There were also other players, like, for example, Heinkel Kabine. Heinkel was an airplane manufacturer, Zündapp. Or Messerschmitt. These were all airplane manufacturers that sort of started going into mobility after the World War. So that was in the mid-50s. And
there's a really, meaning to interrupt, but there's an amazing car series called, oh my goodness, James May on Cars. And it's, Cars of the World, that's what it's called. And it's about the history of cars and car manufacturing. And because of the kind of the post-war scarcity in terms of manufacturing capacity, that's why a lot of these cars were developed, is because they just didn't have any, you didn't have much resource. Like it was hard. You really, like, everything was expensive, but there was a lot of demand for cars. And so these bubble cars or micro cars or whatever kind of emerged. And that was the basis of the Mini as well. Like that was the same, yeah, that's why that existed and the Fiat 500 existed. And so anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, but exactly.
I love this era of car making. It was back when we had, you know, pizzazz.
Yeah, exactly. And there were a lot of interesting designs coming up at the time. I think what, let's say, most struck us about the bubble cars was that they really looked different. So, you know, you had a different width of the wheels, between the wheels in the front and in the rear. So it gave sort of like a teardrop shape, which gave it a really distinct and different look. And because we realized that if you size down a conventional car design down to 2.5 meters, it's sort of going to look a bit shoeboxy. So that was sort of what we wanted to avoid. We wanted to create really a cool lifestyle product, because we also knew that one of the big hurdles for adoption of these small vehicles was also maybe sort of the stigma that might be associated with them, you know, that it's uncool. I mean, a car is a very emotional purchase. It still is sort of a status symbol. I mean, you give a pretty clear statement by which car you drive. And so we really wanted to make something that has a great design, has a great lifestyle. And so that was actually our inspiration, these bubble cars. And we said, okay, let's take these vehicles, this category, as an inspiration and sort of portray it into the future. And how would this have to look like as an electric car? So that was sort of the way we started thinking about it.
Awesome. So take us through the design process. Take us through to like where you are now, because I want to understand, you've got this vehicle, we've got to this part of the story, you've got a vehicle and you're producing them now and you're selling them around Europe. And you've pumped a bunch of these things out. I want to work backwards of like how it got designed, and then sort of a run around on the manufacturing as well. So, talk me through the, like, what are you producing at the moment? Like, how many of these things have you shipped, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so you want to start from the present?
Well, I want to start from the present, and then I want to work backwards, because I just want people to have an understanding of like where you've got to, because this is an incredible part of the story.
Okay, so where we are now is we have our factory in Italy. We're a Swiss company, but we have our manufacturing in Italy, in Turin, because there's a lot of manufacturing know-how there. We have our own company, so we don't work with a contract manufacturer. And we are currently producing, and so this is, we are in April 2023, so we are currently producing 10 cars per day quite soon. So in a couple of weeks, we're going to go to 20 cars a day. Just as a reference, 20 cars a day, that's a rate of around 5,500 vehicles per year, which is already a pretty big deal for us. Yeah. Our factory next year will be able to pump out around 10 to 12,000 vehicles. So we can still increase that. So yeah, but we are already in production. We have a series homologation, and we are now really producing cars in series and not in a prototype shop anymore.
Fantastic. And the vehicle itself is, it's electric. Just talk through the kind of the characteristics of the vehicle. So it can seat two, it can carry three crates of beer, I think is the important part.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's got space for two people next to each other. I think that's super important for an electric city car. If you sit behind each other, in my opinion, the sort of passenger is always sort of, yeah, doesn't have a very comfortable space. I mean, you want to sort of sit next to each other to talk. So that, I think it's a smarter way of designing the product. You have space for three beer crates in the trunk. So you actually got a huge trunk volume, 230 liters, but the volume is also really usable. So if you see it live, you will see that there's plenty of space. You fit even a full-size luggage into the trunk of a Microlino. It's got a range of up to 230 kilometers. With a largest battery pack. So that's 14 kilowatt hour battery pack. And the max speed is 90 kilometers an hour. It can be charged on a house plug in just around 4 hours. So you don't need a specific type of charging infrastructure at home, which is a big USP for customers. And these type of vehicles, or the Microlino in general, is really designed for these sort of routine use cases where you don't need the sort of fast charging or anything. You need the sort of overnight charging because anyway, it's a routine distance. So, you know, you don't take this vehicle when you don't know where you're going to go throughout the day.
Totally. So they're built like city cars and they're small as well. Like the footprint is tiny. I mean, that's the thing that kind of really got me is.
Yeah, you fit, it's a third of a car basically. I mean, you fit three Microlinos in one parking space.
Because you can park them direct to the curb, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's got a front door, like some of the old bubble cars, a front door, which was.
And when you say front door, in other words, the entire front of the car opens and that is the door.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it was much easier to sort of design it and much more difficult to really engineer it. So
yes,
this front door is was really, really difficult to bring also into serious production. But it's super cool. I mean, it's amazing. It's easy to get in and out, and it's super practical in cross parking, right? Because you don't need to think about how much space you have on the sides because you cross park and you just get out directly on the sidewalk. So it's super mm-hmm. super practical, and it saves also a lot of space.
Yeah, I mean, look, for folks who are trying to work out what this thing is that we're talking about, you really need to go and look at a video of it because it is so unlike anything that's for sale in the kind of micro car world. Like everything else that I've seen and that's in the sort of like NEV, low speed, like neighborhood electric vehicle or low speed electric vehicle, they're all just cars. They're built as you know, like standard with the doors on the side. They look like cars, they function like cars, and they're, you know, as you say, Oliver, they are shoeboxes, and they, you know, I'm very excited about them. I do think that there are some interesting ones in the space, as you know. Nimbus, I think, is an interesting one. It tilts. It's you know, and three wheeler. But this is by far one of the coolest ones that I've seen. And Oliver, like, I'm very interested to buy my own one. It's also one of the first like small electric vehicles that I've gone like I would buy one of those. They look fun.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, that's also what we get as a feedback from customers. We already have more than 36,000 reservations and also won numerous design awards. So I think we had a good sort of intuition how to go about the design, also with the inspiration from the 50s, but sort of still putting a lot of modern elements into it. So yeah, we are super excited now that we are delivering the first vehicles.
Excellent. Okay, great. So now that we know where you've got to, how did this happen? Because it's one thing that I, you know, the thesis that we have at Micromobility Industries about how this space will develop is that there will be lightweight electric vehicles that, like, there is the emergence of these lots of modular pieces of technology that become integratable in a way that hasn't been possible before. So you can build small electric vehicles in a way that you couldn't do that with, for example, petrol cars or something like that. It became very challenging to do unless you were at mass scale. So what was the, when you started looking at this in 2015, it was clearly like, this is a kind of a, not a joke, but like, you know, we think this thing should exist. It's a fun project. To like, oh wow, we're going to build these things, and you're clearly building them, in, you know, 8 years later in 2023. So, give me the sort of the 5 minute version of that.
Okay, I'm gonna do my best to keep it short. So we had this idea. We first started working with a Swiss university. There were 9 students, 3 teams. One team did the design, one team did the electronics, and one team did the mechanical engineering. So that's actually how we started. And the idea was really just to sort of make a student project, make a couple of renderings, and have some fun with this sort of idea, which is what we did throughout 2015. And after we finished it, we said, you know what? It would be a shame if we would just leave it at renderings and a 1 to 12 scale model. So we said, you know what? Let's build a prototype. So of course, we checked who could build us a prototype. We checked in Europe, and eventually we also checked in Asia. And then we found someone in Asia that was willing to do a prototype for us for very little money, because remember, at that point, it was really a sort of a PR gag kind of thing. So that was the purpose of it all. And so throughout 2015, so throughout the last months of 2015, we built actually this prototype in China, which actually, it was not really a prototype. It was more like an MVP, because we didn't use any of the components we were planning in series, because we hadn't intended to go into series production. And it was also not, let's say, a design model that you normally know from the car industry, which is really not functional, but it looks exactly like you designed it. So it was neither nor. It was sort of something that looked sort of like our designs, but not really. And it sort of worked, but with sort of an assortment of strange parts we find from some spare parts sellers.
Yes.
So that's what we built. This was the very first prototype. So we decided to exhibit it in Geneva, the Geneva Car Show, in March 2016. Funny story was, we were, of course, that was quite a spontaneous decision to exhibit it there. And they didn't have any space. But then the organizer told us, well, you know, there is one sort of booth where there are multiple brands exhibiting. And in the second row, you could put your Microlino. And that's what we did. So also, if you Google it, there are still some old pictures around. You see our Microlino in the second row on a small little pedestal where we wrote, "This is not a car," to sort of clearly make a statement that you have to think this is a new product category and you have to think of this in another way. And we then also decided to make a reservation list. So we built up a simple website. At the time, it was a WordPress, I think, with a reservation form, which was basically a newsletter form at the end of the day, in which we said, if we get 500 reservations, we're actually going to build it in series. And we really had no concrete plans to build it in series. We had no idea how to do it. We had no experience in automotive manufacturing. We weren't really in talks with any type of partners that could help us in that way. And we were surprised that after 2 days, we got our 500 reservations. So that was really the start. And when we started to realize...
2 days, back in the day, you know?
After just 2 days, we got 500 reservations. That was 2016. So that gave us sort of, you know, that put us in a great but difficult spot, because all of a sudden you're there, you sort of made this PR gag of saying, well, you know, we're going to build 500 cars if we get 500 reservations. And after 2 days, we had the 500 reservations. So we had to react. And we were, of course, also super excited. And at the time, we were quite lucky to find a partner in Italy that was developing small vehicles in a very, very low volume production. So just maybe 100, 200 a year. The company was called Tanzari. It's still existing today. That was sort of, we were able to partner up with to sort of fulfill our goal of making this sort of small batch of cars and to help us develop it and to help us homologate it, because In Europe, you have a homologation, not a self-certification like in the US. So you actually need to go to the official ministry to present your product. They do all sorts of tests. There is a huge rule book that you have to follow. So it's not so easy to pass these tests. So yeah, that's how we started. That was a couple of months after presenting it in Geneva. And so now I'm maybe going to skip a little bit. And then if you want to focus more on one or the other aspect, let me know. So we worked with them around 2 years. We also passed homologation. And shortly before our planned production start, that was early 2019, was a scheduled production start. We got an email saying that, well, good news, I sold my company. Which for us was not that good news because we realized it was sold without any employees. So basically, we had a new partner, and we didn't have a sort of change of control clause in our contract at the time. It was a very light contract. So all of a sudden, shortly before production start, we were confronted with having a new partner that we didn't choose. So it was like a forced marriage.
Right.
Yeah.
Bugger.
And. Just to finish it off, that then this partner started copying us, so wanted to make his own version and things like that. So he didn't really abide by the contract, and we lost a whole year. And eventually we split, and then we completely re-engineered the product again throughout COVID, throughout 2020, 2021, and that's basically what we launched now in 2022. On our own without a joint venture partner.
Yeah, wow.
With our own manufacturing. So yeah, that's the sort of, I try to make it as short as possible, but.
Hey, look, this is great. So you ended up going for contract manufacturer, that contract manufacturer didn't work out. You said, screw it, we're going to do it ourselves. And you've gone and built your own factory and are doing it. I mean, I think it's mad. It's also fascinating because it's like, you've now got 36,000 reservations. And I think the one thing that I've seen in the space for anybody trying to build like lightweight electric vehicles or NEVs, the neighborhood electric vehicles that are these smaller vehicles, it is very challenging to get these things to production, right? So like, hats off to anybody who can do it, including you. And especially for something that is as weird and niche as what you've built, quirky and stylish. I mean, I totally want one of these things. But like, how on earth do you fundraise this? Because the journey of trying to build something like this, like everybody that I've talked to has been massively capital constrained. Can you talk me through that part of the journey for you? Like, how have you managed to do it in a way that like you didn't just effectively say, oh, in mid-2019, like, okay, we're folding this. We're not going to bother. Keep on going.
I mean, it was, of course, a step-by-step process. I think what for us turned out was that the investments were a multiple of what we have budgeted in the beginning. So that's a very common theme. I mean, also we also fell victim to being too optimistic when it came to cost, when it came to investments, complexity, and so on. It was massively more expensive than we would have ever imagined. But sometimes it's good that you don't know that from the beginning. So
yes,
it's, but anyways, I mean, we had a different path than others because we had an existing business that is still very successful. We sell 3 million scooters a year in 80 countries. It's a 100% family-owned company. And let's say we were able to sort of put money aside because, as I said, the company is more than 20 years old. So in those 20 years, we were able to set some money aside. And we really said we wanted to invest our money, the family wealth we have, into let's say new mobility, into innovative mobility, and because we really believe in this product category. So we actually invested ourselves, but that doesn't mean we weren't capital constrained. I mean, it was a huge challenge to actually get it into production. It was difficult. You have to really find a way to bring something to market without spending too much money, and that's a huge challenge. But what we didn't have to do, and I think that was definitely very helpful in keeping our focus in especially a very turbulent phase on just going to market, was that we didn't have to do any fundraising, because the road to series production is definitely not a straight line.
No, completely. Fascinating. So talk me through the next part, which is like, so you managed to manufacture them. You're now doing 10 cars a day. You're going to be shifting to 20 cars a day. Next couple of years, you're going to be getting 10 to 20,000 cars a year. How are you distributing them? Like, because the one thing that I've noticed about a lot of these vehicles, right, is that they are oftentimes the internet is marvelous for these things because people around the world go, that is so cool. And they see it on Instagram and they want to order it right now. And at the same time, like shipping a car to someone who lives in rural France is going to be, or even, you know, rural America or somewhere in Argentina, like if the car turns up and you have no support, it's not a very good experience. So you end up wanting to support these vehicles and way more so than, for example, like a lot of micromobility vehicles, like scooters or e-bikes. Or something like that.
Yeah.
How have you thought about that part?
So, of course, I think like most players, we also started our journey by saying, well, you know, we're going to do a direct-to-consumer Tesla style, some stores, as much as possible online. But, you know, eventually we realized that this type of business model, it wouldn't work in this kind of category and this kind of volumes. You know, if you sell vehicles for, I don't know, 80, 100,000 bucks, you know, you can afford that. Or if you sell a lot of vehicles, you can also afford that. But, you know, when I say a lot of vehicles, I mean something like, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of vehicles, not tens of thousands, you know. So I think we at some point we realized that this strategy commercially wouldn't work out. We also realized that, you know, as we were not having a contract manufacturer, but manufacturing ourselves, we needed some partners. We could not do everything ourselves. So also there, we were a capital constraint. And also we started in Europe. And Europe is a very, let's say, the culture in Europe is extremely different, right? The mobility behaviors are extremely different. So it all comes down to different incentives when it comes to different rules, when it comes to parking. Where can these type of vehicles, like the Microlino, drive and so on and so forth? So it's a very fragmented market in a way. And so you need a strong local partner to also give the trust to the consumer that, hey, this is a great product. This is something I can use for my everyday mobility. And I'm gonna put 15, 20, 25,000 bucks on the table for this type of mobility. Because I think it's and this is really important. I mean, we launched now. It's a very, very different thing from getting a reservation and getting a deposit of $500 or whatever to actually having a customer that ordered a car and paid the full amount of money. There is a huge hurdle from that initial reservation to actually buying it. And you have to build up also the physical components of your sales to sort of make that happen. And I think also Tesla realized that, right? I mean, they wanted to close down their stores. Eventually, they opened them up again. They even created new stores. And, you know, as said, as a newcomer, you have to first get to that sort of brand recognition that Tesla has. You need to get there. And so I think for us, we went back to, let's say, a more omnichannel concept, which is something that a lot of new car brands are using right now, which is basically an agency model in Europe, meaning that we have an importer in each of the markets, and the importer, they work with their dealers on an agency basis. So basically, the importer sells the vehicle to the end consumer, and consumer can decide whether they want to configure it in the store or whether they don't want any test drive at all. They just want to configure and order on their couch and pay do the complete process online, and the dealer gets a commission per sold vehicle. So that's sort of how it works. And this ensures that you have a stable pricing in a market, so there are no fluctuations. And you can sort of have all the possible customer journeys, from someone who really wants to do as much as possible offline to someone who says, you know, I don't even want to leave my home to order this car. I don't even care about a test drive. I just want to order and do that. So This is sort of the strategy we followed and that we are rolling out right now.
Awesome. And who's buying them? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that for me, the fascinating thing was I would ask the inverse question: who is not a buyer? I think for these type of, let's say, two-seater, everyday city mobility type of vehicles like the Microlino, young families are usually not the buyers, right? Because, you know, that's usually the first time most people buy a car, a new car. You know, there's sort of a lot of hesitancy. They don't know how their lives are going to be. You know, are my kids going to play soccer? Or, you know, how many kids am I going to have? So, you know, there are a lot of sort of questions. I think the classic buyers are of course singles, but are also, let's say, people that are, let's say, above 45 50 that, let's say, already have a car and they use it as their second car. I mean, most households have two vehicles, right? So this is really what we see in this initial stage. I think what is also very important, you have to differentiate between buyer and user, because the new car buyer in tendency is always older. Car market is a, and although the Microlino is not a car, I think a lot of the way the market works is still pretty automotive-like, right? You still have an asset that you buy new, and then it's going to be sold a couple of times, right? And so I do assume that the average user will be definitely way younger than what the average car user is. But if you only look at the new cars, of course, also a normal car buyer is usually above 50 years old. That's just the way it is, because the younger ones can't afford. They usually buy a used vehicle.
Totally. I mean,
so we always have to be a bit differentiate between these two.
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me like you need the vehicle itself is so unique that it almost feels like you need the I have this image of a very rich, beautiful woman who's just like, I need a car that reflects my personality. And I am sure that there are, you know, many of those in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our strategy and, you know, our positioning is definitely premium. That's what we want it to be, because we also believe that as a small player, especially if you're starting up, I mean, I think it was very easily visible with Tesla, right? How long did it take them to go from premium really to be really, really mass market? I mean, you need some time to build up your industrial process, your industrial machine, your manufacturing, your relationship with suppliers, your volume. So I think it's a very difficult strategy to enter and say, okay, we're going to be money for value from the mm-hmm. from the first day on. That's why, you know, we really want to position ourselves as premium, and we don't want to be the volume leaders at all. But we still think the premium market in micromobility is going to be something that will become huge. And I think we are at the right place at the right time.
Totally. I mean, it is fascinating watching, you know, like the Citroën Ami, which has done exceptionally well in France. And it's like, it's a plastic thermoform quadricycle. It's not like, you know, it's interesting, but it's not premium. It's and in that regard, I can see that, like, if you want something that's small, the other thing that I found super fascinating about being in Amsterdam, by the way, is that the Beetle, that little like tiny, it's one of those shoebox cars that you talk about. Mm-hmm. The Beetle is a Dutch design car, but that is the car of like the very rich families who live, you know, near Vondelpark. And there hasn't been a really stylish version of these things that have come out yet. And I do think that the market will be interesting to watch in that space. And I'm stoked that you're playing in that place, because I think for a lot of families, they recognize that like the second car doesn't need to be big. I just need it to like have weather protection and be able to get around and maybe have a second seat, so that if we have to put a kid in it, that it'll work. And that there's, you know, that there's a way to signal, right? Like, as you say, the car buying journey is still one of signaling to the outside of like who you are and personality and premium and status and all that sort of stuff. And like micromobility, I think, will become status, a high status activity. It's the way that we see it now with e-bikes. It will become the same for like small little city cars.
Yeah, and I think that's the right way, right? That's how you have to start in a market. I mean, of course, now that we are in production, we are thinking a lot about the future, but we are also really thinking about the next 1 or 2 years, because let's say you have to be successful also the next 1 or 2 years to make it to the next 5 or 10 years. I think what is really interesting to me, and this is something you really have to experience, you cannot really market or explain to a customer. People have to experience using a vehicle like that every day, that really it is enough for 95% of the distances. I noticed with so many of our early customers that they sort of understood the messaging around it. They were like, yeah, it's cool. Yeah, you can use it for most sort of trips. But when they start using it, you know, they're really excited. Like, oh my God, I don't need my other car anymore. It's incredible, you know? And I think what is really, let's say, the mid to long-term vision, and that we really need sort of a mindset change of the people, is that vehicles like this is for your everyday mobility. And you use sort of like a sharing or public transport or whatever kind of, let's say, more flexible way to really then get purpose-built vehicles for these sort of 5% of other trips. Let's say when you go skiing to the mountains, you might want to have a huge car where you can put your skis, or you go for a fun weekend with your girlfriend, you might want to get a sports car, or I don't know, you know. So I think that is really what I think the medium and long-term vision is going to be for these type of vehicles, where people really realize, hey, I don't need more for my everyday mobility, so I'm just going to have my small Microlino, and for all the other distances, I'm going to share some other type of, or rent some other type of vehicle that is really purpose built for what I'm going to use it for at that specific moment in time.
Wow, Oliver, this has been such a fascinating conversation. Is there anything else that you think that I've missed in terms of asking you about what you've built at Microlino that you want to tell the audience?
No, I think it's great to be in this space. We are, I think one important point is, I think we need to join forces, everyone together, to sort of put this idea of micromobility, of space saving, and lighter mobility into the minds of everyone. And it will need our joint forces to achieve that. We are working, for example, on a coalition specifically on these sort of L7 type of mini mobility vehicles like the Microlino, which are sort of, I think, sort of a perfect mix between ecology, but still giving sort of the comfort of a car, weather protected and so on. And we are also really working together with other players to really make sure that this is also on the political agendas, and this also gets the sort of focus it deserves to get, because I really think this is one of the solutions, together with bikes, together with e-scooters, together with many other things, and the solutions will vary depending on the city, of course, but this is one of the solutions that is super, super important to make our cities greener.
Yeah, fantastic. So look, for folks who do want to track this down, I assume you will have already gone and Googled this, because that is such an interesting episode. And I think we will have piqued your interest in what this car will look like. But for folks who do want to try and go and find this afterwards, Oliver, what's the best place to go and find information about it? And then if they wanted to track you down, is there a way that, are you on any of the public social networks?
Sure. I mean, you can just add me on LinkedIn. I'm not that reactive, but I will react at some point. And on our website is microlino-car.com. So you can check out all our all the information, all the specs there. You can also check out our configurator, which is also live. And of course, you can also make a reservation and even buy a car. We already started in Switzerland, Germany, and Belgium, and many other European markets will follow in the next couple of months.
Fantastic. Except, well, hey, look, as I have said to many entrepreneurs on this show, I just, hats off to anybody who managed to get through the production, the gauntlet that it takes to get a vehicle like this to production. So just hats off, because I know it has been incredibly challenging for you. You know, obviously, I imagine you probably had more hair when you started this journey of trying to get a car into production. But yeah, look, just hats off to you, and like, thank you for continuing to do what you do, because it makes, one, my job way more interesting knowing that there are cars like yours that emerge. And also as well, like, I think it conforms to this thesis, right, of like what a better world will look like when we are actually right-sizing the vehicles.
Absolutely.
And by making them available, it's really exciting. So yeah, look, we're hoping to have you in Micromobility Europe in June. We'll see if we can get there, but it would be wonderful to have you there and to have the vehicles to see there as well. So yeah, hey, look, I'm looking forward to having you on in the future when we can talk a bit more about some of the other projects that you have, because I know that this is only but one of the projects that you've been working on. I know you have kind of bigger ambitions of other things you want to do in the micromobility space as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Always welcome. Just let me know.
Fantastic. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.